told me where that came from. But really interesting, right in the middle of talking about spiritual gifts, this is what Paul says. I will pray with my spirit, but I will also pray with my mind. And I will sing with my spirit, but I will also sing with my mind. I just want to reassure you that life is not all about IQ tests. Okay, so in a sense, that is not the pathway down which I'm going. So I want to make you feel reassured that if school was not for you, please don't shut off, because I am not trying to take you back to school and university. One of the most moving experiences I've ever had in my life was a few years ago going to China and meeting some of the leaders of the underground church in China. In fact, I met what they call the five fathers of the underground church. No one really knows how many people are in their congregations. People guess maybe 70 million. That's five men. One of those men, who is, they call the elder statesman of the five, a chap called Papa Lung, enormous privilege to meet him. And I think the best way to describe him is it was like meeting St. Peter. That kind of not immediately desperately intellectual kind of guy, a doer, a fisherman. I actually don't think Papa Lung is a fisherman, but you know, you kind of get that impression. Papa Lung has not even a primary school education. So God is no respecter of the kind of educational system that we think we've been through and what we think about our own IQ. God is able to step in and expand our mind, and that is what God has done for Papa Lung, and it's what he can do for all of us. So this is not about IQ. It's about using our minds, and we all have one, about accessing God. Probably one of the most well-known verses in the whole Bible. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And we're going to keep coming back to that, and now and again we'll be dipping into the Psalms as we do so. But what I want to try and cover today is five different topics. Number one, what are the pitfalls of being an intellectual? What are some of the pitfalls of using your mind and relying on your mind as a pathway? Secondly, I want to talk about the kind of delight that we can have as we use our mind to search for God. Number three, I'd like to talk about the importance of the way that we think. The way we think really does matter. Fourth, I'd like to talk about something of the kind of difference, if you like, or how wisdom and intelligence sit with each other. How do wisdom and intelligence work together? And five, I'd like to talk about faith and reason, which the world tells us are two different things, but maybe not. Okay, let's start off by talking about some pitfalls. This is a famous picture of the thinker. What are some of the pitfalls, do you think, of being an intellectual?
Pride.
Pride, yeah.
People can't understand you.
Yeah, you get a bit remote.
The theory, but no feeling.
Yep.
Dryness.
Yep.
And you can argue God doesn't exist.
Sorry?
You can argue that God doesn't exist.
Yep, you can argue God doesn't exist.
Get trapped in your own thinking.
Get trapped in your own thinking.
God is only as big as you think.
God is only as big as you think.
God is much bigger than you think.
God is much bigger than you think. Well, you're familiar with them all. I love this verse in Galatians chapter 5, verse 6. The only thing that counts, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Wonderful balance between what's going on in your head, if you like, your faith, and being expressed, something that you do with love. That's kind of, if you like, the Christian understanding of what intellect is supposed to be about. It's this balance between what's going on in your head and what's going on with your hands. What are you thinking and what are you doing? We like to separate those two things. God likes to put them together. We're all familiar with kind of people who live in an ivory tower. They divide concepts from reality. And that's a really dangerous thing to do for two reasons. First of all, the concepts end up wrong. And secondly, what people do ends up wrong. So we have to try and keep concepts and reality together. Now, we come from a particular stream of Christianity called Protestants. And I'm sure you know why we're called Protestants. It's because we protest. That's why we're called Protestants. Originally, of course, the big protest was the protest against the Catholic Church. But actually, as you look at the several hundred years since the Reformation, we have kept dividing and dividing and dividing into smaller and smaller churches because we keep protesting against each other. We find something that we disagree about and we part company. I wonder actually whether, despite all the pain of that having happened, what actually was happening as we have protested and left is that we have been looking for different spiritual pathways. That we have said, that pathway over there, which spends its time in the sacraments, is not my pathway to God. My pathway looks like this, and it looks like a Bible on a lectern. And why are we here? Why are we not in an environment where the sacraments are held as the sacred moment? Why are we not in a church with a huge one of these, with a great big eagle and a vast book and people speaking out the Bible for most of the service? Why are we not in that environment? Well, I would say because actually most people, and I know many of you, for most of us, actually, our pathway to God is through people. The thing that we really celebrate in this church is not the sacraments. I'm not saying we don't celebrate the Bible, but we really emphasize people, and this is our spiritual pathway. Again, just in case you were a bit concerned that it wasn't a desperately spiritual thing to be doing, to be using your mind, here's a great encouragement. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind. I gave my life to the Lord when I was, 17 at school in a massive Christian revival that happened in my school. And it was a charismatic revival. Back in the mid-70s. And one of the things about the charismatic revival at that time was that it was mostly about experience. It wasn't about thinking. Now, I like to think. So when I became a Christian and I was told basically to shut down your mind, read the Bible, do nothing else, think nothing else, I didn't find that very comfortable. I wanted to think. Because to me, if this faith that I was stepping into didn't make sense, then why should I follow it? So I left school desperate to think about my faith. And I happened to pursue a particular pathway to doing that. I went to university to study theology and found that that was actually a dead end. And I began to discover that actually pursuing God with my mind in a very closed intellectual environment wasn't actually what God had in mind, at least for me, in terms of pursuing God with my mind. So I had to find other ways to do it. Now, I love this verse here in the Song of Solomon. Solomon, you will recall, probably the wisest man in all history, apart from Jesus. And this is what he says. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. For me, using my mind as I search for God feels like this. God is always slightly through a window, and there's a lattice across the window. And I can look through, and I can see something of God, but I can't see all of him. And as I get closer and maybe peer through the lattice, it's almost like then there's another window with another lattice. So I've moved a bit nearer, but I still haven't fully seen him. So there's always, it's almost like a And this is a very, as you know, a very sexual poem. It's almost like this kind of sexual tease, if you'll forgive me using that expression. As we get closer to God, God reveals more of himself, and yet there's still more to be known. It's a little bit like scientists as they peer into outer space. As they go so far, there's always more. They learn so much, but the boundary is always slightly beyond them. And interestingly, it's the same as you move from the bigness to the smallness, as you peer into the heart of an atom. The smaller you get, the more there is to know. It's an extraordinary paradox. There's always more to discover. It's a little bit like, you'll be familiar with the expression of peeling an onion. There's always another layer inside. Well, for me, discovering God is, it's like starting in the middle of the onion and kind of peeling your way out. There's always another layer, and the layer that you get to next is bigger than the one you've just peeled away. There's a kind of mystery about God as we search for him. God is knowable through Jesus, but he's only knowable kind of to a point. How do we come to terms with what we don't know about God and his purposes and the way he works in the world? Well, at some point, as an intellectual, you have to, or someone who uses your mind, you have to come to terms with this mystery of God and his ways. And I'd like to distinguish, if I may, between two different things. Uncertainty is not unbelief. I'll say that again. Uncertainty is not unbelief. Faith, after all, is a decision to trust when I'm not certain. If I was certain, there's not a great deal of trust involved. Faith is a decision to trust. I love what Mark read out earlier, this question that we have as part of our values, holding deep convictions but being unfazed by questions. I don't know if you've got your Bibles with you, but there's a marvellous passage written on the hearts of every Wyoming, Matthew 28, the Great Commission, right at the end of Matthew 28. And I'm sure you're really familiar with these verses. This is right at the end where Jesus is commissioning his disciples. In a sense, it's the summation of why Jesus came. Then Jesus said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." A really, really well-known passage. But I wonder how familiar you are with the context of that verse. Let me read you a couple of verses that come before, which I think are really interesting. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. So this is Jesus's 11 closest disciples. They are the team. No one knows Jesus better than they do. They have lived with him through highs and lows, and then through the resurrection. And they have met the risen Lord Jesus Christ. Now just think for a moment what that would be like. How would you feel, how would you think, if you had been in that position? And then there's a little phrase that follows on from that, just before the Great Commission. When they, the disciples, saw Jesus, they worshipped him, but some doubted. So some of the 11, right at that heart of the Great Commission, some doubted. Now actually, what does that word doubted mean? One of these places where the English language doesn't quite get the Greek. I'm told actually what that word means is some of them were of two minds. Some of them were of two minds. Or to put it into colloquial English, some of them had no idea what was going on. Now, I don't know if you ever find yourself in that position. You can be extraordinarily close to Jesus, your salvation absolutely secure, an extraordinary ability to speak truth because you have met truth, and yet you have no idea what is going on. One of the great problems that we have always struggled with, mankind has always struggled with, of course, is the problem of pain and why do bad things happen to good people. Can you get your mind around that? Well, what an extraordinary book the Bible is, because the Bible doesn't duck that question. It's like there's an ongoing conversation in the Bible from the beginning to the end about why does pain and suffering happen. I don't need to be certain that I know the answer to that question. I just need to be certain that I know somebody who does know the answer to that question. Okay, I'd like to move on to my third little point, which is the importance of the way we think. Now, I don't know if you can see that. Anybody guess where that is? It's a kind of picture of a muddy, slummy thing on the right, on the left, and then a rather magnificent skyline on the right. Anybody know where those two places are?
China.
No. Well, you won't guess, so I'll tell you. It's actually the same place, except one is called Tijuana, and it's in Mexico, and the other one is called San Diego, and it's in the United States. Now, when I say they're the same place, these are two cities that sit right next to each other, and the only thing that divides them is a concrete wall to keep the Mexicans from moving north. Now, when I say a concrete wall is the only thing that divides them, of course, that's not true. Actually, what divides them is the way they think. Now, the people south of the border in Tijuana are exactly the same people who live north of the border in San Diego. They are exactly like us. Interestingly, actually, they're both Christian. North of the border, Protestant, south of the border, mostly Catholic. And yet the way they think is different. And you can see the effect of that in the way that they live. So the way we think and what we think matters enormously. So going back to my experience at school when I became a Christian and the charismatic revival was telling me to stop thinking, that's a really dangerous doctrine. Because that's where you end up if you don't think. Now, that's kind of on a mega scale, but on a personal scale, this picture can still be true for us. The way that we think really matters to us. A little phrase I sometimes like using is ideas have legs. In other words, your ideas take you places, they have consequences. One of the things, again, YWAM is particularly good at is teaching people about worldview. In other words, what is it that we desire in life? And secondly, how do we achieve it? Now, every society has a worldview. And it's interesting to reflect on what's the worldview of the country that we live in? What does this country want? What do we desire? And then secondly, how do we go about achieving it? I had a really interesting experience with this in 2012, I think it was, when I went to Western Kenya to visit some artisanal gold miners. Now, this is basically young men with picks and shovels digging holes in the ground, going down maybe 100 meters and then out sideways another 100 meters and bringing up mud and rock and crushing it and trying to find gold. It's an extraordinarily primitive and very, very dangerous process, partly because as part of the process they use raw mercury with their hands, mostly the women actually, to get the gold to stick together. But of course they also have accidents down the tunnels. They're quite good at building tunnels. What they're not so good at is providing ventilation for the diesel fumes that come off the electric stuff that they're using when they're down there. So it's a very dangerous process. The reason I was there was because a group of guys thought, kind of together with them, if only we could invest some money, we could help them do this in a cleaner and safer way. In other words, they were thinking, and we were thinking, money will help them out of this problem. Of course, when I got there, I discovered that life was a little bit more complicated than that, because actually the problem that they had was not really their kind of technical skill. It was what they wanted in life and how they thought they were going to achieve it. And when I saw that, I backed off, because I realized that actually if I and friends brought some money to bear on their problem, all I was going to do was make their problem worse. In fact, I'd probably enrich some people who might own the land and enslave further some people who were digging down in these holes. So I realized that actually what needed to change first was the way that they thought. What did they want in life, and how did they think they were going to achieve it? And it was really interesting for me to go there, because it was fairly shortly after the financial crisis in the city. And actually, as I reflected when I was in Kenya on the city, I could see the same thing. The problem in the city was what people wanted and how they thought they should go about achieving it. Now, it's easy to have that conversation and sort of talk of the other. It's easy to talk of the Kenyan miner or the banker in the city, but can I challenge us? What do you want in life? And how do you think you can achieve that? And be really honest with yourself. Don't give me the Christian answer. Give me the real answer. What do you really want in life? And how do you think you can achieve that? Because that is what drives your behavior. And that is what drives, in a sense, the outcome of your life. Do you want to live in San Diego, or do you want to live in Tijuana, personally speaking? One of the great little quotes in that book that some of us have been reading about spiritual pathways is, one reason that Christianity kind of won in Western Europe, back in the kind of pre-Middle Ages, as Christianity was spreading through Europe, one reason Christianity won was because it outthought paganism. It was cleverer. It actually discovered what people really wanted, and it showed them how to achieve it. It outthought the competing systems. Okay, I'd like to move on and talk about how we kind of balance wisdom and intelligence. If I could read this psalm. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose life does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. Not so the wicked. They are like chaff, and the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. Now this is a psalm written by David before most of the Bible exists. There is no New Testament. Most of the prophets haven't spoken. Or if they have, it hasn't been written down. So when Paul says his delight is in the law of the Lord, he's talking about Leviticus. Okay? Is that how we would describe Leviticus or Deuteronomy? This is what David is meditating on and finding delightful. What I love about this psalm is that it balances three things which I think are essential if we want to have wisdom and to grow our minds the way we think. Knowledge and intellect is one, character is two, and experience is three. It's like there are these three points on the compass, three points of the triangle, and there's this constant movement between them. We become better at using our minds, our knowledge increases, our intellect is expanded, if you like, if it's founded on good character and as character develops. And then thirdly, there's this issue of experience, that stuff that goes on in the head but isn't coming out of the right character or isn't based on experience doesn't really work. We all know that if you really want to learn something, you have to do it. Charlotte and I were talking over breakfast about learning to swim. You can read a book on how to swim, and you can even learn that book off by heart, but at the end of it, you cannot swim. The only way to learn to swim is to get in the water. And what happens when you get in the water is it's not just that you learn to swim, but your understanding of what swimming is expanded. So if you then learnt to swim in the sea or the swimming pool and went back and read that book, what that book said would say something different to you. You'd say, oh yeah, that's what they mean, because you have experienced it. It's like the whole thing of being an apprentice. Now, apprentices didn't just sit in the schoolroom, they went out to work. They carved the stone or they chiseled the wood, as well as listening to what the master craftsman was telling them. But the third piece was an apprentice also looked at the way that the master craftsman lived and learnt from that. So there's these three things going on that produce, if you like, the master. And we all want to be, if you like, master Christians. We want to be good at following the Lord. So it comes from your brain, your character, and what you do. Charlotte and I were in the US a little while ago and had the privilege of going to church in the US Naval Academy, where they have a huge big chapel. So this is like a university that produces all of the US's naval officers. It's quite an impressive place. And there was a great sermon when we were there, and he was talking about where did Jesus get his authority from. And interestingly, he said Jesus got his authority from his obedience. Now, interesting in a kind of naval academy to hear that, but actually, as I reflected on that, I thought, yes. And actually, that verse that we read a little earlier talked about Jesus being obedient even unto death. So as Jesus was obedient, as he did what he had been told to do, my guess is that he learnt not only who he was, but also who God was. So it's as we do that we learn. Now, it's really important to include in this learning process the bits that we don't understand, the bits that don't seem to fit. Some of you know I've taken on a role recently with the Bible Society, and they sent me a little book recently called Hear My Cry, which was produced for celebrating, if that's the right word, the beginning of the sort of 1914-18 remembrance. And this little book called Hear My Cry is a collection of stories from men in the trenches, their personal stories, interposed with some lovely poems and some amazing words from the Bible, mostly the Psalms. So in this one little book, you have the description of what it's like living in the trenches next to Psalms praising God. Now, how on earth can you put those two things together? Virtually every soldier in the trenches was given a copy of the New Testament and the Psalms, and they engaged with that as they lived through the horrors of the First World War. How do you engage with that and read a psalm and praise God? I don't know. I've never been in that situation. But there's something about living in that kind of impossible combination that teaches us something about God. My own experience of struggling with something I didn't understand, well, I've had many of those, but let me just tell you one. About 6 or 7 years before the financial crisis, I felt the Lord asking me to start studying what God said in the Old Testament about economics, and particularly around the ban on charging interest on debt. Now, God doesn't really explain that in the Bible. He just gives it. Don't. Doesn't particularly say why. And I spent 6 or 7 years trying to understand that. It was like that description I gave of looking through the lattice. As I got to one level of understanding, there was another one slightly beyond it. It took me 6 or 7 years to understand why God said what he did say about debt and interest in the Old Testament. And then the financial crisis happened. And the reason I'm telling you that story is, one, just to say that meditation is a long, slow, lifelong process. It's never finished. But also, secondly, you never quite know what God is preparing you for as you go through that process. Okay, fifth, I'd like to talk about faith and reason. And I really chuckled when I saw this verse the other day. Forgive me, Elizabeth. It made me chuckle about enthusiasts. It is not good. The reason for that was Elizabeth spoke about being an enthusiast, and she did it very enthusiastically. It is not good to have zeal without knowledge, nor to be hasty and miss the way. In other words, do not be an idiot. Now, the great challenge of our day is religious fundamentalism, and we prayed for that this morning. But that's not a foreign problem in the sense that it sits over in the Middle East and is not affecting UK culture. We have to battle in the public square and in our private lives with others who think we are religious nutcases and have nothing valuable to contribute. So we have to engage with this issue ourselves. And I'd like to give you a couple of quotes from Pope Benedict the 16th, that's the last pope before this one, who was a brilliant theologian and really understood about engaging in the public square. And in 2010, he came to the UK Parliament and had the rare honour for a pope of standing in Westminster Hall, which is the vast old medieval hall that sits next to Parliament. And he addressed the House of Lords and the House of Commons together. And this is one of the things he said. It's a really complicated sentence, I'm sorry about that, but I'll read it and then I'll kind of highlight the bit that I want to emphasise. The role of religion in political debate is not so much to supply moral norms as if they could not be known by non-believers, still less to propose concrete political solutions which would lie altogether outside the competence of religion, but rather to help purify and shed light upon the application of reason to the discovery of objective moral principles. What I'd like to emphasize from that is what he's saying is the role of religion, the role of our faith, is to shed light upon the application of reason. The role of religion is to shed light upon the application of reason. Now, a couple of ways. There are many, but a couple of ways we can do that. One way is that our faith allows us to think outside the box. Reason can get locked into a closed-ended logic. What faith can do is open that box and let other things come in that provide out-of-the-box solutions. Things like forgiveness and generosity. There is no logic behind forgiveness and generosity. They are outside reason in many ways. but they kind of manage to break the logjam that reason can lock us into. Another way, of course, that religion can shed light upon reason is by religion acting as a kind of plumb line, if you like. Love your neighbour. Really simple plumb line. Love your neighbour. And any aspect of personal or public life can be held up against that plumb line, and we can decide, have we drifted too far away from the application of that principle? Second thing the Pope said, and in their turn, distortions of religion arise when insufficient attention is given to the purifying and structuring role of reason within religion. It's a two-way process. The world of reason and the world of faith, the world of secular rationality and the world of religious belief need one another and should not be afraid to enter into a profound and ongoing dialogue for the good of our civilization. In other words, religion without reason goes off the rails. And we have seen that many, many times, and we continue to see it. A really good question to ask ourselves is, am I being reasonable? If not, is the reason justifiable by faith, or is it a question of religious error? Now, what I'm talking about is not a dispute between, if you like, godly faith over there and ungodly reason over there. These things are not good versus bad. They're not godly faith versus ungodly reason. And the reason why I say that is because God created reason. So when you have faith and reason in dialogue with each other, you have God in dialogue with himself. Now, others may not see it like that, but we can. Reason and faith are both created by God, and they're both given to us as gifts. So we do not need to feel that there's a tension in applying them to each other. I'd like to close by going back to Solomon. In addition to being the wisest man, apart from Jesus, who ever lived, he was also an amazing scientist for his day. He was very wise, and he was a great scientist. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He spoke about plant life, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He spoke about animals, birds, reptiles, fish, and from all nations people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. Solomon is one of the great biblical examples of someone who combines science and religion, faith and reason. Faith, his relationship with God, improved his mind so that he understood birds and reptiles better. But also his mind, as he looked at birds and reptiles, improved his faith. And in a sense, that's what I want to encourage us with today, that as we use our minds, God can improve our faith. But it's always important for those of us, which is all of us, who like to use our mind, to remember where we sit in relation to God. And this is my last slide, which hasn't come through terribly clearly, but I think you can see what it is. We all do well to remember that we are but dust before the awesomeness of God, and we need to keep our intellects in proportion to his. Thank you very much. One of the things sometimes we do at the end of these sessions is to ask whether people have found anything helpful from what has been said, and it's important to emphasize that is not done to boost the ego of the person standing here, but sometimes it's just helpful to speak out kind of what have I connected with, what's helped me, and it's also actually really helpful for other people to hear that too. So if there's anything that you have heard that you'd like to say, yeah, that's really made me reflect or think, or that would be good to share.